Blog Talk Radio.
Found us again, Masonic Effects, and welcome. I need to do a shout out really quickly. Yes, we have an interesting international crowd. You truly are amazing, and with the greatest respect to listeners from Zambia and Russia and Japan and Greece and Brazil and the United Kingdom and Canada and the USA. Thank you. Thank you for joining us and being such frequent flyers on this ship. I'm having a hermetic crisis. You've heard of hermetic seals. Well, I'm having a hermetic crisis. I've been looking into it again. And some of it is scarily meaningful to me lately. Everything in motion. I don't just sit and think that I have to recite these five. But, you know, to understand them is far, far more satisfying. It's like instead of describing a meal in a fine restaurant, it's tasting it. It's enjoying it with your company, of course. That's the point. I agree that reality is a mental process. It's a processing, something that we process. We have sensation, we have sensory experience that pulls in information about our environment. But it doesn't pull it all in, does it? We see certain things, but we know there are other spectrums of light that aren't perceptible to our eye. Some animals can pick them up and insects can pick them up, but you and I are not able to at this point in our evolution, as I said, there's a cloying qualifier. So I don't see it all. We look and I can see small, but I can't see infinitesimal. I can't see a molecule, but I can. Some clever person invented a microscope, and so I can see that. Can I see an atom? Can I see a particle? Can I see a quark? Are there things that exist that I might not be able to perceive? That's where the mathematics and the physics begins to engage philosophers. And that doing that upsets the the bias around me that philosophy is meaningless. You know, you can't, unless it's, well, I live in a world, unless there's some profit to it, then we're taught that life lacks meaning. There needs to be some profit in every, some gain in every function. Otherwise, it has no meaning. I don't agree with any of that kind of stuff. It's not worth getting into here. The everything mental suggests to me that the dilemma that I face day by day is largely of my own making. I do have choices, and I'm not pointing a finger at somebody and saying that calamity, that atrocity was perpetrated on people that had choices. I would not be that. That's unethical. That's first off, it's immoral, and I don't think that way. And have I reconciled this? No, my goodness. There's more questions than answers here. So if you're looking for somebody as brilliant as yourself with all of the answers, I bumble along and try and calculate and piece things together. So do these things fit together? Not cleanly. I wish it did. But it's only because I don't necessarily understand the beautiful mathematics that there is around me. But I understand that there is beautiful mathematics around me. So that said, I guess in a way, I'm not suggesting that you just change your mindset to add Masonic effects. It becomes epic. I wouldn't do that. No, I'm thinking more about some of the seriousness that is going on. And I think that there's a world out there in the future. There's a point in the future where we will see a reconciliation of function through masonry, and I think it's going to take a while. You may criticize me for suggesting that humans are capable of this kind of feat. Yes, I understand that criticism. Is it my entitlement or arrogance or naivety or all three that make me suggest that is there a probability there, Graham? There is a potential that for enlightened men to connect and for that enlightened body to grow, but not. As I pull back on that, I'm not suggesting every single person that displays the apron. No, that would be arrogant of me to suggest that. There will always be people coming to Masonry for the quote wrong reasons. Always, there always was, and there always will be. We define the ideal state. We define it in ideals. What's the right? Is there a right reason for coming? Well, if there is, who's to determine it? Certainly not the people that I've none of the scholars that I read or that I think have a good grasp of masonry today. I don't think they would ever suggest anything. But we have. We do have a lot of people of less capability, less awareness, that are quite prepared to tell, to explain, to offer an edict that explains what is the right thing to do and the right thing to think. I was at one of these training ceremonies some years ago over on the other side of the province. And a fellow innocently asked a question and got an answer that didn't make any sense. And he was following it up like, where does that answer come from? And the response was, that's the way it is. That's the way we say it is. And I thought, I almost lost my gum when I heard that. But it just was so poignant. It captured the problem that so many Masons were experiencing. One or whichever side of that discussion you're on, if you're the recipient And I've seen people ask permission over sort of amazing sort of domestic things, as if they can't lift their right hand without getting an authority behind it. The lack of, I'm not talking about paternalism here. I'm talking about perceptions, and the perceptions here, raise other questions, certainly. For the questioning, probing, you know, we want to help, we want to breed a healthy skepticism into the minds of a responsible, active Freemason. However, we know that this can be associated with the disloyalty and be uncomfortable, and therefore something to be best avoided. So we have work to do. We have time to have that broad understanding. That broad understanding is a work in progress. And along the way, we have the state that we could argue is as good as it gets for us at any given time. The turmoil is like the crash of a wave on the shore, an adventurous wave. It's not an intention of a wave, but it's the inevitability of a wave to crash on the shore. All that energy is dissipated. With us, I noticed that scholarship, I don't think it makes us immune to it. I think understanding makes us immune to fretting. So who knew that the hermetic thinking, everything is emotion. So we are in a constant state of change in order to survive. I feel comfortable with that. And if you look at, you know, human biology, we can say, absolutely, every day the clock is ticking and it has a different effect on me. It may be infinitesimal, and they go unnoticed, but it is the change. And that never stopped and never started because of me imposing my will or my thinking or my opinions. Doesn't matter. I can claim that I have absolute control of the universe, but I don't. You know, no one of us is able to predict tomorrow, and we do very well to predict today. but those are things that that come secondary when we're second. When we are trying to find that experience, we're trying to create the experience that really is quite an exciting event, where a meeting of the minds and where performance is refined, and where our expectations of others are the effect of what we're doing is more erudite conversation. For example, is there a right time? When is the right time to bring? Sometimes the mentioning and saying things, the way we phrase things, is less significant than the timing. Saying things in an appropriate time or the most optimal time that they will be received is an art in itself. Just understanding the timing. That's an art that we would want us to portray. Maybe it is as simple as tolerance. We will go ahead with scholarly debate. And between strangers, it may look and sound like entitlement. It isn't. The way we handle curiosity. I know we live in a world. Where competition is keen. But what happens if you just don't care? What you're focusing on isn't competing, but getting by the best way you can. living life in a wholesome way, and carrying on with your mates. I think that's more than a reasonable and achievable part of life. Today we're going to examine something that I've been waiting a long, long time to examine: the writings of Gilgamesh. And I'm offering it up to you as a piece of poetry, because that's what it is. You know, and how did I come to this? Well, I was reading something about cuneiform writing, and I was wondering, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal with cuneiform was that in order to be literate, you had to understand every single symbol. There weren't inference, and it lasted for thousands of years. But what it could describe was clean and clear. But again, you had to memorize and know every single symbol. Those little triangles and the position of them and the clusters of them. And then, you know, gradually we found better improvements. We found better and improved ways of doing it so that we didn't have to have the exact spelling. We didn't have to know the exact phrasing. We could put notes together. We could put letters together in different configurations to get a similar outcome. If you've read material from 15th, 14th, 15th, 16th century, you see spelling was not necessarily the same. So, and it could vary day by day. Those things, you know, standardized spelling came along. Fortunately for us, we have larger populations than we were back then. So it's helpful. It helps us to make sense, and that's necessary to be able to have some accurate communication, meaningful communication. We're transmitting ideas, and we want, at the very least, to connect with people that are understanding the idea that we're putting across to them, that the challenge is, and perhaps we're not the most articulate. Maybe the way that we've toned the explanation has surrounded us with an unintended or unexpected bias. So the feedback gives us that information that we require. And that's, I think, absolutely necessary. Absolutely. So we have a start, always a start. And now we'll wire this back up and let everybody get involved again, engaged. We're having a good program today. Understanding and practice. Our practice as Masons continues. I'm going to do my best to explain the epic Gilgamesh and how that, a little bit of it. I certainly can't do it justice, but I certainly can explain. I'm going to grab some more coffee because obviously I need that. And in the meantime, I'll push you off shore here with a little Keith Jarrett, just to... because this is his tune, Endless. just a homage to wonderful musician. If I'm not mistaken, I believe the man is recovering from a stroke. I think he hasn't left us, but he's certainly graced us with this incredible stockpile of beautiful music. Beautiful. Here, sit back, grab your favorite beverage. Understanding and practice. Our practice continues. We don't compel a man to find relevance in masonry, and we never have. We're cautious. The trust we hold in one another is not overrun by charlatans. But when they slip in, they are of little subsequence to Masonic purposes. Draw your attention to what is happening around you. Look carefully into the shadows, and you are likely to find students, serious students of the craft. They're not trying to dominate the conversation. They've embraced humility because it is what they found in ritual, the influence of service to mankind. Character that does not require the limelight or compensation. To be motivated by altruistic reasoning is liberating. It's one of the moments a man is free and knows he is free. Yes, of course, there are rewards for surrendering to mainstream thinking, to look around, to look and sound like everyone else. Don't call it freedom. Freedom is free will. To think and act independently. It's not anarchy or subversion. It's agency, independence. But is it your truth? These beliefs are about using what the Creator gave us at birth, infused with what we gained as we walk through life. If we could all agree on what it meant to be a decent person, much of our work would be done. At least masonry attempts the impossible. It attempts to draw men together by resetting our filters. Gautama Buddha once said, our life is shaped by our mind, yes, become what we think as the possibilities. Do we choose material gain? Why not, huh? Do we choose dominance? Do we choose a path of enlightenment and brotherly love? Choices made clearer when we sit at the side of philosophers. Or, in my case, I sit at your side and listen to you philosophize. And it's just amazing what we learn. Why not? Bill Evans, why not? Poetry. I'm stretching us today. This is the work. I'm stretching us into an epic poem, Gilgamesh. This is, and bear with me. Yeah, and I've gone off on another tangent here. My goodness, yes. Gilgamesh is the, and getting this from, I picked this up from the World History Encyclopedia. Good place to, oh, please do visit it. Just, and if you were one of those boys that you just, you know, when mom and dad brought home the encyclopedia and you read it, well, you're going to find this really interesting. Gilgamesh is the semi-mythic king of Uruk, best known as the hero of the Epic of Gilgamesh, 2150 to 1400 BC. And this is the great Babylonian poem that predates Homer's Iliad and Odyssey by 1500 years. And it stands as the oldest piece of epic world literature. Gilgamesh features in several Sumerian poems, but is world famous from the Mesopotamian epic. Now, if we were all classically trained, then this might be, and probably was, something that we would have been experiencing in our curriculum. But for many of us, this is something that we pick up in adulthood. Historical evidence for Gilgamesh's existence is found in inscriptions crediting him with the building of the Great Walls of Uruk, which is in modern-day Warqa, Iraq, which in the story are the tablets upon which the first record he first records his quest for the meaning of life. He's also referenced in the Sumerian king list, 2100 BC, and is mentioned by known historical figures of his time, such as the king Enmebaragisi of Kish. I don't apologize for going slowly over that. Besides the legends which grew up around his reign, the quest for the meaning of life explored by writers and philosophers from antiquity up to the present day is first fully explored in the Gilgamesh epic as the hero king leaves the comfort of his city following the death of his best friend Enkidu to find the mystical figure Utnapishtim and eternal life. Gilgamesh's fear of death is actually a fear of meaninglessness. Ha ha. Let me read that again. Gilgamesh's fear of death is actually a fear of meaninglessness. And although he fails to win immortality, the quest itself gives his life meaning. Now let me jump just a bit here. Yeah, here we are. There's so much. Here's a quote and why I brought it to you. No one can see death. No one can see the face of death. No one can hear the voice of death. Yet there is savage death that snaps off mankind. You see, the gods killed. There was a battle and Gilgamesh fought with Enkidu. And they became friends. And it turned into love. And because they slew the heaven bull, the two of them slew Humbaba, the guardian of the mountains and the forest of cedar, one of the two must die. This is what the gods decided. The great gods, Anu, Enlil, Ah, and Shamish held an assembly, and Anu spoke, one of them must die for this. Let Enkidu die, for Gilgamesh must die not, Shamish said. However, spoke into Enlil, Was it not by thy order that these men slew the heaven bull and the guardian Humbaba? Why should the innocent Enkidu die for this? But the god Enlil, burning with anger at Shamash, said unto him, each day thou traveled with them like unto a companion. In other words, you're biased. And so Enkidu died, was killed. And the reaction, the result was for Gilgamesh was crushing. As you heard, no one can see death. He was distraught. Although he had a wife, he was absolutely distraught at this love. And he spent his life searching for immortality. He must not die. The role of knowledge and wisdom, this comes from Gilgamesh, is most obvious when Gilgamesh realizes he is afraid of death and seeks to find eternal life. He comes to realize that life is about death, but making the most of the life we have. He occupies his time by seeking out and conquering the most difficult of tasks. Does Gilgamesh truly attain wisdom? While not attaining his goal in a literal sense, the wisdom Gilgamesh gains on his journey allows him to become a truly wise and just king, and thus achieve a different sort of immortality. Who is the god of wisdom in Gilgamesh? Siduri, otherwise attested in Mesopotamian sources as a goddess associated with wisdom, which, according to writers and researchers, matches her portrayal in the Epic of Gilgamesh and as an epithet to Ishtar. What does Gilgamesh teach us? But of course, the major teaching from the Epic of Gilgamesh is that death is inevitable. Gilgamesh wastes so much time and energy in a futile effort to find eternal life. And what makes Gilgamesh finally accept his destination? At the end of the poem, Gilgamesh realizes that his city and his journey are what will keep him in memory even after he dies. He can finally accept his mortality because his great city and its carved walls will tell his story. Is Gilgamesh a wise king? The poem begins by explaining that Gilgamesh, although he thought he was wise in all matters, had to endure a journey of travail in order to find peace. Two-thirds human and one-third deity. He was unusual. The hero as king is unaware of his own strengths and weaknesses, and he oppresses his own people. Shamat, the prostitute, has a paid job which enables her to support herself. She works to serve as men. Gilgamesh entrusts her with the task of seducing and taming Enkidu, the wild man. She reveals her charms and makes love to Enkidu and tries to convince him to accompany her to Uruk to meet Gilgamesh. Is Gilgamesh meaningful today? For Western cultures, the Epic of Gilgamesh is where literary history begins, and many of the conventions in the story stones of later literature, including the journey of a hero. Joseph Campbell picked up on that name. The concept of the epic poem and the themes of good versus bad, life and death, mortality and duty. So is it meaningful? Depends who we're talking with. in this, there is a rejection of one of the gods. And these gods are personifications of us, of the human condition. Metaphor, yes. The more complete Akkadian account comes from the tablet 6th of the Epic of Gilgamesh, in which Gilgamesh refuses the sexual advantages of the goddess Ishtar, the East Semitic equivalent of Inanna, leading the enraged Ishtar to demand the bull of heaven from her father Anu, so that she may send it to attack Gilgamesh in Uruk. Gilgamesh is widely accepted as the historical fifth king of Uruk, who reigned in the 26th century BC. His influence is thought to have been so profound that myths of his divine status grew up around his deeds and finally culminated in the tales that inform the Epic of Gilgamesh. Later Mesopotamian kings would invoke his name and associate his lineage with their own. But most famously, Sol-Gyor, considered the greatest king of Ur. This is 2047 to 1750 BC. My goodness. In Mesopotamia, claimed Lugalmblanda and Ninsun as his parents and Gilgamesh as his brother to elevate his standing amongst his subjects. The Akkadian version of the text was discovered in Nineveh in the ruins of the library of Ashurbanipal in 1849 by the archaeologist Austin Henry Layard. Layard's expedition was part of a mid-19th century initiative of European institutions and governments to fund expeditions to Mesopotamia to find physical evidence to corroborate events described in the Bible. While these explorers found instead, however, was that the Bible, previously thought of to be the oldest book in the world and comprised of original stories, actually drew much upon much older Sumerian myths. The Epic of Gilgamesh did likewise, as it is informed by tales, no doubt originally passed down orally and finally written down 700 to 1,000 years after the historical king's reign. The author of the version Layard found was the Babylonian writer Shin-Lik-Unini, who wrote 1300 to 1,000 BC, who was thought to be the world's first author known by name until the discovery of the works of poet priestess Enheduanna, 2285 to 2250 BC, the oldest author. Daughter of Sargon of Akkad, Shin-Lik-Unini drew upon Sumerian sources to create his story and probably had a significant number of work to work from, as Gilgamesh had been a popular hero for centuries by the time the epic was created. In the Sumerian tale of Inanna and Hulupu tree, for example, Gilgamesh appears as her loyal brother who comes to her aid. Inanna, the Sumerian goddess of love and war, plants a tree in her garden with the hope that one day making a chair and bed from it. The tree becomes infested, however, by a snake at its roots, a female demon in its center, and an Azu bird in its branches. No matter what, Inanna cannot rid herself of the pests and so appeals to her brother, Utu-Shamish, god of the sun, to help. Utu refuses, and so she turns to Gilgamesh, who comes heavily armed and kills the snake. The demon and the Azu bird then flee, and Gilgamesh, after taking the branches for himself, presses the trunk to Inanna to build her bed and chair from. This is thought to be the first appearance of Gilgamesh in heroic poetry. And the fact that he rescues a powerful goddess from a difficult situation shows the high regard in which he was held even early on. These tales represent him as a great hero, and the historical king was eventually accorded completely divine status as a god. He's regularly depicted as the brother of Vianna, one of the most popular goddesses in all of Mesopotamia. Prayer is found inscribed in clay tablets addressed to Gilgamesh in the afterlife as a judge of the underworld, comparable to the wisdom of the famous Greek afterlife judges Rhadamanthus, Minos, and Achaeus. In the poem Gilgamesh, Enkidu, and the Netherworld, which draws on earlier myths, Gilgamesh is given a first-hand account of the afterlife by Enkidu, who has returned from Uruk-Skulal's dark reign where he went to retrieve his friend's lost items. Depending on different interpretations, Enkidu may be a ghost who delivers this version, making Gilgamesh the only living being to know what waits beyond death, or if Enkidu is understood to have survived his trip to the underworld, only one of two, not counting the divine Dumuzi. The cuneiform tablets of the work discovered by Laird in 1849 and translated and published by George Smith in 1876 make up the standard version of the tale. Any modern translation relies on these 11 tablets, but sometimes a 12th is added relating Gilgamesh, Enkidu, and the Netherworld. This story is usually omitted, however, as Enkidu dies in Tablet 7 and his appearance in Tablet 12 as a servant and not Gilgamesh's friend makes no sense. Enough? I think. Now, why bring this up? Some of us read the Odyssey and the Iliad, and some of us don't. And we're looking for, we're trolling through, we're sifting through it for, you know, the epistemologist in us is sifting through this. For early evidence of ideas. Ideas. Now, it's as I read, is it practical? Well, we have today. Well, we have some opinions that tell us that it is. Do we study it just because it's old? Well, I think that's terribly unfair. It would be like saying, I'm going to take you to my favorite opera, La Boheme. I'm going to take you, Puccini, I'm going to take you there just because I have an extra ticket. How wrong could that be? How wrong? Why? Now, to treat, is it a treat? If it's not, you should not, you know, find your own alternatives. My goodness. But if it is, then we take it in. He became a man. He attired himself with clothes, even as does a husband. Truly, O Gilgamesh, he is born in the fields like thee. The mountains have reared him. During my night, I, having become lusty, wandered about in the mists of omens. Eat bread, O Enkidu. It is the conformity of life, of the conditions and the fate of the land. She tore off one garment and clothed him with it. With a second garment, she clothed herself. O Enkidu, arise. I will conduct thee unto Enna, dwelling place of Anu, while Gilgamesh oppresses the souls of men. You may never pick this up again, which is perfectly understandable. But then again, who knows? I've been picking through the history portion for today. The clear motif that has been current in this telling, Living the Enlightenment, you know, is freedom. I wonder today, is there a similar motif here? Is this present, or are we off on some other plane? If I put the question to you about freedom today, I think it would be a lively conversation if we could engage in it. Are we free? Well, in what terms? Philosophically or economically? Politically? There's questions to be asked. And I'm not clear of the answers myself, although I think it's relative, yeah. So here, bear with me. This is a time of, remember, we're talking about loyalists and we're talking about turmoil, political turmoil in the Netherlands. And particularly, we were hearing from visitors from Amsterdam. And we are in the background is the influence of British Freemasonry and Masonic values as translated or interpreted or displayed in London. The Masonic order, the brothers are reminded, originated in the superstitious centuries and was then transmitted to our better enlightened times. Every effort is being made to be joyful. A general hospitality pervades the meeting, and we are told that the master is filled with patriotic, disinterested, and freedom-loving feelings, even in this time of unrelenting attack, lustful oppression, and the violation of the most holy alliances of our neighbors. Although vague as recorded, the remarks tell us that the events of the moment pervaded the meetings. In this instance, the lodge was hailed as a refuge from the world, a place of friendship and hospitality. At the next meeting, concerns about the political and economic situation in the Republic become more explicit. The welfare of the people is at its greatest low. Then there is discussion of the three known forms of government without a preference expressed in the minutes. Did some brothers favor monarchy or aristocracy or democracy? Perhaps there were voices raised for all three. At the very next meeting in 1782, a proposal comes from the Grand Lodge in The Hague to conclude to an alliance with the freedom-loving and now independent lodges of the Great East of North America. 1782. In these troubled times, the Dutch had supported the American colonies against their commercial rival across the channel. Critics of the Stadtholder had been particularly avid for the American cause, for which loans were raised in circles, in patriotic circles in Amsterdam. Also in 1782, a treaty was concluded between the two nations. In concluding the Masonic alliance with the American brothers, our Amsterdam Lodge was now open to American visitors. Within a few months, a brother arrives from a lodge in Pennsylvania to effect this alliance and correspondence with the Free Brothers of North America. The visitors from America arrived at a good moment amidst discussions that were going on in the lodge about the nature of government, about the best form it should now take. If men were discussing the forms of known government and deeply distressed about the condition of the people, they might have much to learn from discussions with Americans recently successful in their search for freedom and independence. And with that success in Pennsylvania had come a major expansion of Freemasonry in the new state. In 1778, the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania had made a firm commitment to the revolutionary cause. Historians of Dutch and Anglo-American republicanism are beginning to recognize that despite their different languages, Dutch and American republicans shared a conceptual universe that decreed tyranny and the decadence of entrenched interests, and that looked to the Romans and to the more recent republicans of the 17th and 18th centuries for guidance. Conversations such as the ones that went on in Le Bien-Aimé may have facilitated the forging of a transatlantic republican consciousness, which the Pennsylvania brothers saw must have been impressive. Freedom, the motif. Freedom on what level? Intellectual freedom, meaning? Interesting. Today, particularly, the truth is whatever I declare it to be, according to some media, who have, and people who have discovered that without accountability, they can say just about anything and feel validated by it, even whether it connects with the facts or not. Opinion. There's been a struggle for opinion to be more important than fact. It's like the politicization of intellectual currency. I think it's nice that, you know, I suppose I don't even know if it's inevitable whether this has always been going on in the background. But will it fail? Facts are facts. Here, this is a departure for me. I usually play, for years, instrumentals. I think the only voices that you've heard on this, the last one would be Zaz. I usually play her French chanteuse. Lovely. I usually play her around the Christmas season. And this is the music of a young woman, a Spanish woman, Andrea Motis, and she's playing it with the Joan Chamorro Quintet and on sax Scott Hamill. Now, Joan Chamorro teaches music, and he forms these. He has talented young musicians, and I mean young, in their teens, and they play jazz. And it's just beautiful. That I think is quite captured by this whole project. And this young woman doesn't speak fluent English. She interviews in Spanish. And here, when she's singing, she sings in English. I think he knows, her teacher knows the audience is out there for this. Now, you'll hear this in an old favorite of some of us. This is called Summertime from Porgy and Bess originally. But this version, I just thought was this was just so amazing that I wanted to end the show today and let you decide. Tell me what you think of her. And the articulation, again, is as a young woman playing with sound, yeah? Let me know. And by the way, thank you for tuning in. It's a pleasure, again, to have you here. We'll see you again soon. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And take a moment for yourself.